You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, February 15th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Tara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And George Robb.
Seattle! Yay!
So Evan is not with us because he's busy doing taxes, because that's his day job, and that's the time of year that it is. And you know, I do want to point out, George, that you know, you're appearing on a lot of our live recordings
yes.
of the show. This is all a part of the fact that we're doing the Extravaganza tour.
Yes.
So we're all together doing the tour. You host the Extravaganza.
I do.
And apparently some people don't know what that is. The Extravaganza is a stage show that
what?
We do that's
what?
Comedy and improv.
How
and
dare they not know what the Extravaganza
music?
Is?
Music.
Right. So you're going to be with us on the tour.
Yes.
And so you are going to be part of a lot of shows going forward whenever we're doing a live show during an Extravaganza.
Yes,
weekend.
So get used to it.
Yes. Kara, funny. Tell us about your T-shirt.
Oh, you can read this, can't you?
Yeah.
Can anybody else?
Ya Heart by Kunur.
Ya is I?
Ya is I. Yeah, the backwards R is Ya.
Yeah.
By Kunur.
By Kunur.
What does that mean?
We went 2 weeks ago for the long weekend to do the tour, and then I went straight from New York. These guys went home. I went straight from New York to Baikonur, which is a city.
I love baklava. Is that
yeah, almost. It's a city in Kazakhstan. It's where the Cosmodrome is located, where the Soyuz launches from.
Wow.
So I got to spend...
It's a very sexy rocket.
It was. It was very sexy. I got to spend a whole week... Oh, yeah, isn't Borat from
Kazakhstan? Yes. Yes, that's why I said it. Come in my capsule, see what's happening.
Yes. Didn't meet a Borat while I was there. I was hoping to. No, it was amazing. It was my first rocket launch, so it was a pretty historic place to do... To see my first rocket launch, you know, that's where Sputnik was launched from. Oh. I mean, this is like really historic. And so, and you know, this is a place that used to be incredibly top secret. It was a very important Russian base. And now, of course, it's a global kind of use thing. And it's where our astronauts and astronauts from around the world go
for
up
a
to,
while, anyway.
To the ISS for the time being.
Is it touristy or is it? Do you have to kind of have a special...
No, you have to have special clearance okay. to get there. And it's also... It's an airport. I mean, Baikonur has an airport, but it's a charter airport. Mm-hmm. So I flew from New York to Moscow, Moscow to Nur-Sultan, Astana, which is in Kazakhstan. And then we took a charter flight to the rocket launch out there. And it's funny because there is like a little stand where they sell T-shirts that say I Heart Baikonur. So there's a bit of a touristy thing to it, but there's so few people that go that it's not over the top. But
so you trusted that that shirt said what you thought it said?
I asked that's, around.
Oh, you did? Oh, good for you.
Yeah. Okay, most of the people there spoke. Right.
And you trusted the guy that you asked.
Yeah, exactly. And it was really cool because we watched the launch. It was a midnight wake-up for a 2:40 a.m. launch. It was successful. I was there with OneWeb, which is a company, a British company that is launching satellites for global mm-hmm. coverage. Very different from Starlink, though.
It was a satellite launch.
It was satellite launch. Very different from Starlink. I asked about it. It's actually going to be one of my next episodes on Talk Nerdy because they're going much higher. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not naked eye. But it was really cool. It was 34 satellites. They had done proof of concept a month ago. This was their first, like, proper launch. It was really neat to watch them and the phase separation and stuff. And
what
then,
was the rocket, like...
It was on Soyuz.
It was, okay.
Yeah, the Soyuz brought them up. Yeah,
it's, so it's pretty
it was
big.
Very cool. It was huge. Yeah. Yeah, I felt it in my guts.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Tell,
weird.
Tell you
yeah.
were telling me about that.
Yeah,
tell the
like,
audience how that
you're
feels.
Sitting there. It was kind of strange, though, because this was like a proper business launch. So first of all, there was no countdown. So it just lit. And we were like, whoa, you know, because I was recording for audio. And then it launched and you feel it like shakes you and it's all goo. And I was listening to it with my shotgun mic too, so that was intense. I had to like turn the gain down.
How far away were you, if you had to guess?
1 kilometer.
1 kilometer.
1 kilometer away. Yeah. Yeah. And then it's very bright and it's beautiful and it sort of just like disappears into the sky because there were a few clouds, so once it got behind the cloud cover, it just like lit up the sky and went away. But nobody cheered, which was weird.
That's
I was
weird.
Like, ugh. Yeah, everybody was like, okay. okay, it worked.
I got that
done. Yeah. And then it was, you know, it was a few hours before we knew if everything was successful. Yeah. But it was very cool because they gave us a behind-the-scenes private tour of the Baikonur Cosmodrome Museum at, like, 3 in the morning, which was random. So everybody's cracked out and, you know, we haven't slept and there's, like, little Russian pastries and the whole tour is in Russian and we had no idea. The Cosmodrome Museum is amazing. It's, like, perfect Soviet kitsch. It's a lot of really cool vintage stuff and you can't read anything. Mm-hmm. But there's history. I mean, there's, like... what was the dog's name? Laika. Yeah, it was launched from there. So there's a whole thing mm-hmm. dedicated to that, dedicated to the first women in space, dedicated to Yuri Gagarin, like all the really cool.
That's cool.
Amazing.
I would love to see that, man.
Yeah, if you have an opportunity to see a rocket launch, do it. It's really. I saw the launch of the Maven probe, which was sent to Mars. It's probably a bigger rocket because this is going all the way to Mars.
Could have been. Do you know? Like, do you know where it was?
It was in Florida. Yeah,
So you don't know, but you don't know the name of the rocket. Yeah, because I learned about the Air Astana. Like the company that does these, they have a light, a medium, and a heavy. So there's like Vega is the light. I can't remember what their heavy is called. And Soyuz is their medium.
Yeah, yeah. This was on the heavier side. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it was launching something. Yeah, it had to be to get all the way. Although it was a small, you know, probe. It was going a big distance.
The overall weight, though, was tiny.
It was amazing.
Yeah. I saw the last shuttle launch. That was
That's
awesome.
So freaking cool.
That was amazing.
Where in Florida?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We got lucky because you never know when they're going to call it. Oh, we can't do it too much. Mm-hmm. You know, there's lightning predicted or too much. Yeah, and I just got totally lucky, and it's like, I'll never forget.
Yeah, this launch was rescheduled twice. So I was glad I was able to go. And we had a contingency for 2 extra days. So, like, if we couldn't do it that day, this is what happens if it's -1, -2. So we were also lucky that it was all clear to go.
Imagine, I would have loved to have seen the Saturn V take off.
Oh, man, right? Would that have been cool?
Yeah, but close, too, up close.
Well, you know, but we'll have an opportunity to see rockets that big launching, you know, when you know, both the Orion gets fully, the space law system gets fully operational, and
the SpaceX.
SpaceX, they're heavy, and I'm not sure how that compares to, not the lift rocket, but the spaceships, but, you know, the Starship. That's going
to
be
SpaceX
huge.
Is all out of, because I've been, it's weird to me that I'm as old as I am and I live where I live, and this is the first rocket launch I went to was in Kazakhstan, because I live in L.A.
Yeah.
So, like, there's so many launches out of, in the Mojave Desert. SpaceX does a lot of stuff there, and some of them apparently you could see from L.A., but I've never gone out to do that. Do you know if most of those SpaceX Starlinks are happening?
I know they use a lot of NASA facilities.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, for the big stuff.
Those are much smaller, though, right, in terms of rocket size, booster size?
That's the thing.
Size?
It depends. So for example... OneWeb uses Soyuz, but there were 34 satellites going up at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that in order to do these constellations, it's a really brilliant design where, like, first, you know, they pop off and then they, like, pop out. So there's, like, it looks like popcorn. Like, they separate, then they separate another way, and then they separate, and eventually they're all separate.
That's cool.
Which is really neat, yeah.
This is a great time to be a fan of space travel because, you know, first, the thing I'm totally dying is I want the SpaceX command module. Like
the Dragon capsule.
The Dragon capsule is going to send people up.
You know, this year, maybe.
And, you know, this is a touchscreen. Okay. Like, this is a sci-fi looking interior, which I find very exciting. And I just want to hear what the astronauts have to say about it, you know, because it's such a cool environment. I think, it can fit a lot of people.
Up to 7.
It's very comfortable. Yeah. It's very ergonomic. And then, you know, we got, you know, whether it happens in 2024 or not, moon missions are on the way. You know, they're interviewing astronauts right now for the new moon missions.
Yeah, so if you're interested, NASA's hiring.
Oh, yeah, I've been seeing that, the articles. I also got to, it was a decommissioned Buran at the Cosmodrome Museum, which the Buran was the Russian version of the
shuttle. Oh, they had
shuttle.
That there?
Except it's like way bigger. And it's like got these tiles. It never flew.
It looked like
one time and it like the roof collapsed or something. Like it never actually
It looked
made
like
it.
To me the way that a space shuttle looks like when it's made out of Legos.
Yeah, it's like a
it's very blocky, right?
It's blocky. It's a big, it looks like a
totally,
shuttle.
Man,
yeah.
That is made out of Legos.
And
great.
And they're tiles on the out, like shielded tiles. But it was really cool because it was decommissioned so you could go into it. They had turned it into a museum and then you got to go into like the cockpit. And it's like everything, like the old school looking computers and all the buttons.
I mean,
come on,
that is such a knockoff of the space shuttle.
Of course it is.
That's such a big, have a space shuttle too, you know? No.
Why'd they just paint it a different color?
It was 1989.
Yeah, last gasp of the Soviet attempts at being superior at anything.
Yeah.
Right towards the end.
All right, so we have curated some news items for you, and Bob, you're going to start us off. telling us about Snowball Earth.
Yeah, the scientists recently aged a crater, and they more accurately than they ever did before. And they, based on how old it was, they realized that this is the, in fact, the oldest crater on the planet that we have identified.
Oh yeah.
And it could have potentially ended one of the Snowball Earth episodes that the Earth has experienced in its lifetime.
So wait, you mean the meteor strike could have helped the Earth get back out of the snowball situation?
Exactly, exactly. Okay. But first, I want to talk about the crater itself. It's called Yarrabubba, which is probably the best crater name ever, right? Yarrabubba. This is in Australia, in the outback.
Is that an Aborigine name?
I don't know.
Could be.
Where did the meteor come from?
Spice. Do I have to tell that story now?
No, they don't.
I won't tell that story. Big, 70 kilometers wide, huge crater. Of course, this happened a long time ago, billions of years ago, so you can't really even identify it from space, but it's there. They have identified it. It's pretty solid. So Snowball Earth, this has happened three times in our past. This is a period where, you know, we have glaciation periods where from the poles you have glaciers pulse out and then they go back, pulse out. But sometimes it just keeps going. And they think that at three points it covered almost 100% of the Earth. They don't think it covered 100%. So by the equators and big areas of the ocean were probably, you know, melted, were still liquid or slushy. There's a slushy Earth hypothesis as well. So this has happened for three times. Photosynthesis essentially stops. There's still a lot of life, but I mean, this is a pretty drastic period in Earth's history. And these last for 10 million years, about 10 million years, three times for 10 million years.
So photosynthesis stops.
Right.
It's all chemo.
But then what, are there seeds that are left over?
Yeah, there's hypotheses of animals that could live in the water, in liquid areas in between the glaciers, under the glaciers.
But where's the plant life come back from?
The Snowball Earths all were before multicellular life. Right.
So this is all when it was bacterial.
It was just all when there was single
cell. Well, I mean, cyanobacteria. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah. I guess that's
so. Blue-green algae still photosynthesizes, though. But yeah, it's
But there was photosynthesis happening, right? I mean, it's
but it was in these.
It wasn't conventional plants
algae.
Like cyanobacteria, things like that. So now, how does this thaw? You got the Earth. It's basically a huge snowball for 10 million years. How do you come back from that? Right? It just sounds like it would just stay like that forever.
Well, just to reinforce that, because you know of feedback loops, right? Like when. Beyond a certain point, like when the Earth gets hotter, it gets hotter, right? There are positive feedback loops. There's a runaway effect the other way too. When the Earth gets colder, it gets colder, and so there's no natural cycle, they think, right, that would have brought the Earth out of a snowball Earth. Once you're a snowball Earth, you're a snowball Earth, unless something reverses it. And
right, and the theories for that, some of them are volcanic outgassing, right, Jay? CO2 outgassing. Whenever I hear the word outgassing, I think of Jay. I don't know why. There's also some rocks.
Don't touch me.
There's some rocks absorb CO2, and if it's covered with ice, then it's not absorbing CO2. It builds up in the atmosphere. It gets hotter and hotter and hotter, and then that could thaw the Earth. That's another hypothesis that they're talking about there. So the new research, they dated Yarrabubba, and they figured out this is like 2.229 billion years old. This is the oldest crater on the Earth. So it coincided. The big discovery was that once they dated it, this crater was formed right when Snowball Earth was thawing, the very first Snowball Earth 2.2 billion years ago. It coincided with that. So does that mean that there was some relationship between the meteor and this event? So what they did was they found these they found minerals in towards the center of the crater in Australia. And these were minerals like, there's zircon and monazite. I never heard of monazite before. So they found these crystals. These were shock recrystallized. Mm-hmm. So what happened was something really nasty happened to these crystals. It basically changed the microscopic structure inside the crystal. That's pretty telling. If you look at this under a microscope, something huge happened to these crystals. And what happened is that it basically reset the aging process of these crystals. So what happens is that you've got uranium that is decaying into lead, and that happens in a fixed way. So that you compare the balance of lead and uranium, and you're like, okay, this is how old it is. But when you have such an impacting these minerals, it resets the clock, and the lead just kind of like evacuates, and then the aging process starts again. So this is how they timed it so well. They know that exactly when this happened. So they're really confident, 2.229 billion years ago. And so now the evidence is not just the timing, though. The timing is pretty indicative of a relationship, but it's also numeric modeling. They ran some models, and they said, what would happen if a meteor of a certain size hit a continent that was basically just probably what, a mile of ice or whatever, a huge amount of ice. And they figured this would throw into the atmosphere half a trillion tons of water vapor, which water vapor is a greenhouse gas, right? Yeah. So that could have been, if not, maybe not fully responsible for the thawing, the big thaw, but it could have been a major contributor to the entire thing. So that was one of the big discoveries.
What would that look like? Half a trillion tons of water vapor, yeah. Like in the atmosphere, yeah? Like that's the weather, basically. It's just 100% humidity, like super saturated outside.
And then the heat would called like a hyper greenhouse effect type of thing. Weird. The only other interesting thing, I was looking into what was Earth like 2.229 billion years ago, and it was very, very different.
Boring.
What? Boring?
A lot of ice. I'm sorry.
Not what you're saying.
No, the Earth. Yeah. No, not you. No judgment on you.
Okay.
It's just like if you wanted to read a book back then, like you totally couldn't.
Bob, don't talk about that. It's boring.
Wait a second. Earth was really cool.
No, this period of time on Earth, there was like multicellular life, just unicellular life, just microbes. There was no multicellular life. Mm. And before that happened, it was just methane, carbon dioxide, and then cyanobacteria got into something really good. They started producing this byproduct called oxygen. Have you heard of oxygen? This poison, it basically killed anaerobic bacteria all over the planet because this is toxic stuff.
So they basically killed themselves with the byproduct of their own metabolism.
Yeah, I don't know if it directly killed themselves because there's still anaerobic bacteria around.
Yeah, but they made the Earth inhospitable
to themselves. Yeah.
I mean, you basically just said that bacteria killed themselves with their own
farts. Yeah.
That's what happened.
Yeah. Leave it to Jay to come to that specific conclusion.
Other creatures evolved to eat their farts. That's us.
We're breathers.
We're fart breathers.
Yeah.
I'm just going to end it right there.
Holy shit, George.
Literally.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, don't you love, though, like you have this over 2 billion year old crater and a bunch of guys can go and gals can go and look at it and be like, this is what we think happened.
Yeah.
And they're pretty damn probably spot on to what occurred.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the... What other process would allow you to do something? 2 billion years later, this is what we think happened.
Yeah, you don't see a bunch of homeopaths going out figuring shit out.
Or psychics or just anything.
They claim to. They just make it up.
Of course. But I mean, and this is probably, it's probably pretty accurate in terms of, it's just so cool.
All right, let's go to the other end, George.
Yes.
Boring.
Oh, Robert.
Tell us about this magical broom trick I've been reading about.
This is like the polar opposite of guys figuring out how 2 billion year old chemicals work. A trend happened recently, which was hashtag broom challenge. Maybe some of you saw this, where apparently NASA said, and I quote, because of gravitational pull, brooms can stand up today.
Sounds like a NASA quote.
Yeah. Sounds like an official NASA press release.
By NASA guy.
So this was the original tweet. As far as anybody could tell, this was the first tweet where someone posted a picture of a broom, sort of one of the flat bristled, the bottom's like flat like that,
like
and you have the
broom?
Like a push broom. Yeah, so not like a traditional witch broom, but like a push broom. It's
a sweeping broom.
A sweeping broom.
Not a push broom.
Oh, not a push broom.
Push
broom is
because the handle goes out at an angle.
It's just a square.
It's a square bottom.
It's a square bottom. Yeah, like a rectangle. Yeah.
We couldn't find one in the hotel. They only had the witch brooms.
It's still a straw or a simulated straw.
It's got the bristles. Yeah,
but it's like a big rectangle.
Someone posted a picture of one of those standing in their kitchen, just standing by itself, and they said, "Okay, here's the tweet." Okay, so NASA said today was the only day a broom can stand up on its own because of the gravitational pull. I didn't believe it at first, but OMG. This thing got retweeted 50,000 times.
How many of those were like irony retweets?
Maybe. Don't know. But people started posting that, oh my gosh, it's so true. And they all started doing it on their own. And they realized that, yes, because of gravitational pull and NASA's instruction, today only, you could stand a broom up. And celebrities started, Paula Abdul, she took a picture. The Milwaukee Bucks officially posted a thing. And hashtag broom challenge was trending. Karen North, who was from public affairs officers for NASA, said, no. She said it was harmless, but people should fact check before jumping in the latest viral craze. What ended up happening was people said, okay, this is NASA has said because of some gravitational event which is happening, which then slowly turned into, no, it's because it's the equinox. Even though the equinox doesn't happen for a month, the vernal equinox doesn't happen in February,
sounds like science.
Science.
Yeah. We're like right in between a solstice and the equinox. Like it's like right it's the most non-equinox time
of the year.
Not that it matters, but it's probably also quantum. I think.
Right, but it relates to this idea of on the equinox you can balance eggs on their end. You know, that's a thing too, that only on the equinox and the overall point being is that you can balance a broom any day, any time. It just takes a little bit of effort and you can do it. It's a low center of gravity. It's got a wide footprint. You just sort of twist it a little bit, the bristles go and it stands up, and it's kind of a neat trick. And even though the handle is sometimes angled, it still stands, and it does look kind of strange. Wow, what's going on? But it happens.
Something must be wrong with gravity.
Obviously.
I mean, was there any?
And this is the only thing which is affected, or brooms.
It's only brooms.
not the skyscrapers, not the thing that, you know, not
the
tides.
The tides are fine.
Tides are fine. Sunset's fine.
And the explanation was because gravity.
Because gravity.
Well, didn't they attribute it to some alignment or something?
Well, here's the thing. There is a thing going on. There is a planetary alignment. So if you look out, you see Mercury and Venus after sunset and Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn right before sunrise. This is happening now lately. Mm-hmm. And so Paul Sutter, who's an astrophysicist, he said this, I hate to be that astronomer, but the planets don't care about your broom. I like that a lot. He went on to say, when you're done balancing your broom, you can go outside and see five planets in the sky at night. Yeah. I thought that was really cool. So, but it, again, relates to this not checking anything, jumping into a thing because something happens under certain circumstances doesn't mean that it doesn't happen any other time or whatever. Mixing up pseudoscience with semi-science.
A shocking level of scientific illiteracy.
Shocking level.
That's the most galling. It's like,
because there's zero face validity, but people forget about face validity. Like, does it make sense first?
Yeah, but why, if gravity increased, why would it make something more stable?
That's what I'm saying. It doesn't. Right. It makes no sense even on its face, which is why, like, you don't really
have to go much deeper than that.
Oh, decrease. Well, the other thing is, too, like, when you talk about gravity, and this was one of those things I found out a long time ago that was very easy to throw in people's faces as a skeptic, you know, when you're young and you're armed with skepticism and it's like a super soaker. a salt shaker in New York City has more gravitational pull on you than the planets do. Mm-hmm. Just think about that, because it's proximity, right? So, there is no measurable gravitational effect of those planets on the
fly moon. Landing on your shoulder has a larger influence on your weight and your mass than the moon, than any planets.
Is anybody watching the HBO show with, what's his name? What's it called?
About the thing?
About the spaceship.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Avenue 5.
Avenue 5. Is anybody watching?
It's very fun. It's actually very fun.
That just reminds me of the
Oh, totally,
the
the enumeracy.
Orbiting the
spoilers.
Ship.
I just saw the first episode.
Oh, it's fine. I didn't give anything away, trust me.
This does reveal a general misunderstanding of, I mean, how even gravity works. Yeah. You throw a word around like gravitational or because of gravity, and you go, oh, okay, science thing. And it reveals that a huge number of people just don't understand the basics of if that were true.
They think it's like a magnet. It just pulls on you.
But why are only brooms standing? Like, if this is a planetary effect because of some kind of a thing, like, that there wouldn't even be this thing of like, wait, are we safe? It wouldn't be like, oh, let's tweet pictures of like this gravitational anomaly which is causing brooms to do something they never do any other time. We're all good to go, but let's stand the brooms.
Yeah, it was interesting to think, like, what do they think is going on?
Right. Yeah. Right.
They don't.
Right.
And that's,
like, even if they think maybe it's not just brooms, just one example, but even still, like, okay, and so what? What is happening?
Is it
in
a
your
lack
head?
Of curiosity?
They don't never take it there.
Well, it's a fundamental lack of skepticism at all. So it's this like gut punch, look at pretty pictures, because we know that there's an effect. It's called the truthiness effect that psychologists have studied before, where they gave people, and I learned this during brain games, but they gave people headlines and they said, do you think this is true or not? And people voted. And then they just put a picture next to the headline. Didn't matter what it was, didn't matter if it was true, it didn't matter anything, and people were more likely to say it was true
because there was
a photo next to it, an image, right? So it's the truthiness effect. And so I think you just see something, you see a demo with an explanation, it doesn't matter how deep it is, oh, it's a thing, I can see it, I have evidence, right? And then it's like, it requires another layer of thinking for 2 more seconds. Yeah. But most people just don't. They're like, moving on. That's what it is. They're not thinking any more deeply about it.
The first time I saw a laminar flow video, ever see laminar flow videos?
Cool.
You know, it's if you're not, you don't know what it is. It's basically if you can get the situation, the circumstances right, like on a balloon. You fill a balloon with water and you punch a hole in it, and as the water pours out, it ends up looking like it's just solid glass.
Yeah,
it looks like it looks like it's not moving. It's really, really cool. And you can film this, and it's called laminar flow. It's this effect. And the first time I saw it, I was just like, there's no way that's real.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And dove in and then like took 2 seconds to learn, oh no, this is a thing. Because you go to Wikipedia, what's laminar flow? How does it work? Oh, okay, cool. As opposed to just going, this is real, this is fantastic, and the planets are colliding because of it or whatever. Yeah.
The angle I like is that gravity is the weakest force
of the forces.
Of all forces. It's like millions and millions of times weaker. We don't know why it's so weak. It's so weak.
How weak is it?
For example.
Please.
Thank you, Steve. The entire planet Earth is below my iPad. The entire planet is pulling on this, and with just a little bit of force, look it, I'm lifting it. It's so weak. The only thing that makes it super important, the main thing, is that it's long acting. You know, the
long
other
distance.
Force. The other
distance wise.
Yeah, the other forces act within atomic diameters.
Right.
The gravity works throughout the entire universe.
But
that's
the forces
why.
Argue with each other, Bob. When, you know, strong forces like I'm strong. Gravity's like, yeah, but man, I go on forever.
Right. No, it's just so funny that.
But even still,
force
you can the inverse square law, right?
So right. The drop off. Yeah.
The drop off is still huge over over distance.
But this argument, not argument, but this conversation right here is like 9 million times more sophisticated than what we're talking. You know, and like this question that's being asked.
It's the difference between thinking and not thinking.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a fundamental like.
But it's not just thinking. To me,
it's curiosity.
It's like why.
It's also a lack.
Why isn't this cool to you?
Basic literacy.
I don't know.
And
I
that's
mean,
really a bad part. It's the basic, like when we see these surveys or these Gallup polls about GM and people are like, GM foods have DNA and people don't. You know, like these basic, because they hear buzzwords in science, but they don't have the fundamental information.
My point is not to ridicule necessarily because there is not an encouragement for curiosity. Mm-hmm. It feels like on many levels the culture dissuades curiosity on some level, and yet in other ways it completely embraces it and
it's all happening.
It's all happening.
But there are subsets.
Right?
Yeah, it depends on what subculture you are, you know, whatever.
Or even what the topic may be. I mean, like a celebrity does something, let's say, and people want to know all about it. They want to know the details, and they want
to
do it.
That's a cult of personality.
Dive.
I mean,
it's a curious thing.
Guys, it's part of our psychology. And, you know, this didn't upset me that much because it made sense. It seemed like a phenomenon.
Yeah.
There's something like pedestrian about it, meaning everybody could do. Hey, oh my God! I pulled my broom out and I'm doing it. You know, and to a lot of people, they're not into science and critical thinking.
Yeah. But I think this is what's going on psychologically here. I think that there's a threshold phenomenon where if there's some topic about which you know almost nothing, it's a black box to you.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And so, how do you deal with the black box thing that you don't know anything about? So if, you know, some people are just curious about everything. Like you want to have at least a minimal understanding of something, so it's something other than a black box. But for other people, like they're happy to know about celebrities or sports or politics or whatever, mm-hmm. or music. They have multiple areas where they know lots of stuff. But then there's areas that, all right, I know so little about that, and that fund of knowledge is so overwhelming, I'm just going to forever treat it like a black box.
Yeah,
so and that's like, what, so science is a black box to some people.
Or even
so if you say,
aspects
yeah,
of science.
Because science, that's like, okay, I'm not going to get any deeper than that because it's like I'm going to have to spend years of my life trying to understand it on a deeper level than I currently do. So, okay, fine.
Right.
Science.
It's like like for some people, like sports could be that way or fashion could be that way or science fiction or, like prog music. I'm not interested in prog music, so that exists in its own thing
I
and
love
whatever.
Prog. You don't like prog.
No, I love it. I'm just saying, like.
I know, what are you talking about?
I 45 minutes. But
I think the black box phenomenon is dangerous, and you should really resist
totally.
Falling into that because it makes you vulnerable.
And then it's compounded by the platform, right? Because we're talking about social media where like it's a Twitter thing and people only have this many characters and this many. And so it's like a quick hit and move on, you know? And there's no kind of, there's no culture around digging deeper.
But is this something we should actually care about or be upset about? Or is this... Because, you know, look, as an example, like I'm never going to like get super into prog rock, you know, but I would call you if I had a legitimate question or if like prog rock was making the broom stand up, I'd call you.
And I think Rick Wakeman did it. Rick Wakeman did it. Yeah.
But I think what we want people to do is just please just take one step.
Yeah.
Right. Don't become a scientist. You don't have to go out there and read 15 science books this year. But at least do one thing. I don't know. Go to Snopes. Do something.
Or just literally Google.
Just Google it.
Because you will find immediately within the first page.
Or is today the equinox? Something like that. Yeah.
What is an equinox?
Even not that. Just like, oh, this only happens on the equinox. Today must be the equinox. Wait, is today the equinox?
What is it? Yeah.
No, it's not the equinox. You know, like right there. Okay, then the whole thing unravels.
Yeah, and the difference between thinking and not thinking.
Right.
But we do care about this, and we say this all the time. Not because it matters that somebody thinks that they can stand a broom up on some random day, but it's because the same exact phenomenon leads people to go, oh, vaccines cause autism.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, because science, because some scientist said something sciencey, about it. So that's as far as they go with that too. Right. Yes. Whereas if you Google that, you'll find that, oh, no, experts don't disagree with this. This is bullshit. So,
but that one, at least it takes more work because there's a whole, agenda-driven campaign around it. Something like this is, pretty easy. And I think that's why it's so frustrating to see. Like, it's so quick and easy to debunk. But the question is not, do these people have the skills to do so? Are they interested in doing so? Like, obviously, if somebody had Googled it, they would have figured that out. But there was no interest or inclination. It was like, okay, sure.
Yeah.
Makes sense to me. Yeah. Move on.
All right, Jay.
Yes. We're going to talk. Well, I'll start. We're going to ask the audience a quick question. Who here owns a cat? Who here out of you people has an allergy to your cat or a cat?
Three people, four, five, six people.
But who would own a cat if they didn't have an allergy? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the same six people.
Yeah. Who here has allergies to cats and doesn't own cats? Is that the question? Yeah. A lot of people.
Who would eat cats if you didn't have the allergy?
Six, seven people.
That's what we're saying, right?
So, yeah, I have a cat. I had two cats. Now I have one cat.
Oh my God!
Yeah,
Jesus.
Yeah, that sucks.
Yeah.
Did you eat the other cat?
No.
Too soon.
So
seriously. Yeah.
So the idea here is that a lot of people know. I have friends that come over my house and they're wicked allergic. And just the other night, a friend of mine, I was petting my cat, and then the hair kind of comes off as you pet a little bit, and I'm petting down to her butt, and then I kind of just go like this with my hand, like everyone, get that stuff off my hand. You know what I mean? And he's like, don't do that. And I'm like, why? He goes, that's the shit that gives me the allergies. And I'm like, really? And I didn't really know. Like, I really did not know why people are allergic to cats. This is days ago. I'm like, yeah, what? Isn't it the hair or the dander or something? What is it?
Weren't you curious, Jay? Why don't you just Google it?
And so he did.
And here I am with a whole handful of information. But it did make me upset. And I immediately got the vacuum cleaner out. And I'm like, meh. And that's apparently not good either.
Because it kind of blows it out the back.
Does it have a HEPA filter at the back?
So now to rewind a little bit, we have a San Diego company that was breeding cats to be hypoallergenic, which was really cool if it's true. They had a 15-month waiting list. They called them sniffle-proof kitties.
Sniffle-proof?
Sniffle-resistant.
Stupid marketing.
They probably paid somebody a lot of money to come up with that term, sniffle-proof.
I'm going to ask a couple of random people to tell me how much they thought the cats cost. So why don't you tell me? What did you think the cats cost? Let's throw out what do you think a company is charging for a hypoallergenic cat?
$20,000?
$3,950.
Okay, so let's
a lot
deal.
Of money.
It's
I would have guessed more like you. But still, $4,000 for a cat, which you can get for $100, and it comes pre-neutered and all
for
that.
Free.
Pretty much for free,
From the street.
So the company was called Allerica. Yeah.
You just go to your neighbor's house and take the cat. Yeah,
the company was called Allerica, and it's not a bad idea. There's a ton of cat owners out there. I mean, there's so many cat owners out there that cats are the number one reason for bird death, right?
Cats are actually, not feral cats, but outdoor cats are actually, we should do a story on that. It's very, very bad ecologically.
We've talked about it.
Oh, wait, don't let your cats outside.
Outdoor cats, both domestic and feral, are responsible for on the order of magnitude of several billion bird deaths per year. And then more like mice and voles and all that kind of stuff, which is not that bad. Those are vermin.
I mean, the cats are basically like the sharks of the world.
But they're not because they're domesticates, and that's the problem, right? Yeah. Like they wouldn't be in that niche otherwise if we hadn't put them there, which is, anyway.
All right, so anyway, so this company ran into some troubles, you can guess. What happened was they stopped taking orders. I'm getting a phone call. I had, like,
From where?
Just hit decline.
Wait, no, wait, listen.
What?
Hello?
Hi there. My name's Denise. I'm a promotional host with MGM Casino.
Hi. I'm sitting in front of an audience of 400 people right now. Can I call you back?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you. Okay.
Yeah! Yeah! Nice.
Yeah! Right?
That's all it takes to get them off the phone.
Oh,
that's
my
so
God.
I was going to prank the hell out of that woman.
Oh, my God.
Woman.
That was amazing.
How often do you have 120 people? You know,
she didn't believe you. Did she totally think?
She heard the noise.
When you heard the laugh.
Okay. That's why she was a disappointing.
I thought she said, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, it was a yeah.
I bet she never heard that before, right?
That's hilarious. Oh, my God.
Oh, God. I was Steve. Thank God I didn't go where I was about to go, because you wouldn't have liked it. All right, so anyway, so this company, in 2010, the company Alerica stopped taking orders, and they started getting sued by the people who bought the cats. So two things. One, they didn't fulfill a lot of the orders, and two, the people that got the order said, I'm still having an effect. So they didn't get there. But I think that's a pretty interesting item. Like, they were literally selling non-affected, you know, the cats were not actually modified in any way. I couldn't find any information.
Really?
On
it didn't say, it doesn't necessarily mean they weren't less allergenic than other breeds of cats, because hypo is a relative term, right?
It's not non. It's not 100%.
Yeah. So
yeah, maybe
argue,
yeah, maybe they did, but when I unravel this
advertising though.
I don't think I looked it up and I couldn't find anything about their technology. Yeah. What they were claiming, I think their marketing was basically like, "You're not going to have an allergic reaction to our cats." Right. They probably did something, but it could have been pseudoscientific. I couldn't figure it out. Okay, so but don't let this get you down, because there's a lot of other companies out there that are doing stuff, and one of them, of course, is CRISPR. So CRISPR is probably going to be one of the technologies that they're going to use. There's a company using CRISPR right now to genetically change cats. And their hope is to make it so the cats are completely allergen producing free.
These germline modifications?
Yes.
Probably.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's interesting.
And if this technology...
Otherwise it's not viable.
It's cheaper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they wouldn't. Yeah, the other way would be way too expensive. So if this technology does get produced, the cool thing is it'll be able to be rolled over into pollen, dog, dander, and dust mites as well, which are other huge, like, household allergens that we have to deal with. So, okay, so this was the fun part that I learned about. So the culprit of all these allergies is what? Does anybody have any idea what? I know you do, Kara. What is it?
Saliva.
It's in the saliva.
Who said?
It's a protein in the saliva. And that protein is called FELD1, right? Would you say FELD1?
FELD1?
Maybe. It depends on how the scientists say it. They might say FELD1.
Okay. So this is a small protein. It's produced primarily in cats, in their salivary glands, in their sebaceous glands.
Oh, it's in their sweat, too.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So the cat cleans itself by licking its fur. And what happens is it's just putting this protein all over its hair. It sticks to the cat's hair. It sticks to the cat's dander. It sticks to your hair. It sticks to your clothes. It sticks to your furniture. It sticks to anything that is porous, like, you know, like cotton type stuff or whatever. People that go to visit your house take the dander into their house, and now they've got it in their house. This stuff is everywhere. It's in our world. It's like bacteria. It literally,
it's like the cloud.
It just goes everywhere. all cats produce it. There are some a lot more than others. Like a huge, you know, some cats are naturally just super low on this, that people that normally have allergies, hey, I'm not allergic to your cat. Well, that your cat probably has a very low...
why don't they just breed that cat?
That's what apparently they were doing, right? Just breeding existing hypoallergenic, you know,
and then
breeds.
Just charging a lot of money for it.
And charging up the wazoo for it.
Yeah, but that takes a lot of time. That can get timely. You got to, like, figure out that the cat has a low count of the allergen. Then you have to find other ones, and you have to breed it.
Making a stable breed can take time.
Yeah. The other cool thing, or bad thing, but from a science perspective, is pretty interesting. This protein is so tiny that it can just become airborne. Now it's floating around, and it's in the air, and it can go and land on surfaces and everything. So if you have a cat and people have an allergic reaction to it, it's everywhere.
Jay, isn't CRISPR also working on a cat, apparently, that will lick your butt?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Now, you guys understand, when you do comedy, you're supposed to say yes to whatever the other person is saying.
Yes, and.
I instinctively had to say yes to George, and then I had nothing. I didn't know where to go with that.
There's no there.
So here's what some of the research is showing. So non-neutered cats have a higher level, so they know that it's very likely that it's linked to male hormones. People can take antihistamines, and people can also get shots, and the shots are very... I don't know if you've heard about this, but the shots are bad. It's a lot of shots over 3 years. You know, if you want to be someone that can have cats and get
these
shots.
They're just typical allergy shots.
Yeah, but it sucks. Yeah. These allergy shots.
No, it takes a time because they have to give you like a really tiny dose.
Yeah.
And then just very, very quickly, sidebar, the way they work is you make blocking antibodies, which are a different kind of antibodies than the allergic antibodies. Mm-hmm. Right, they're IgG versus IgE. And then eventually you have antibodies to the allergen so that you block them and so you can't have the allergic reaction because your other antibodies are blocking.
But you have to build up to that?
But you have to build up to it. Yeah. Otherwise, you can't just give them a full shot because they'll get an allergic reaction.
Do you know what they call that? It's called desensitization.
Desensitization.
I had to slow down when I said it. There's too many Z's and S's in that freaking word.
Paracetamol.
That's cool. I didn't know that worked. It's basically the general... allergy.
That's their general allergy shot.
Yeah, so it's not special to cats, right?
Peanuts or peanuts or whatever, yeah.
So why do they do the thing where they do the scratch test? That's just to see what you're allergic to. Oh, okay.
All right, so they're trying, now we have lots of companies now that are trying to come up with a way to handle this. And in this, this is really an exercise in understanding how the immune system works. So it turns out the immune system, it isn't like this single response, like, you know, something is irritating you, you're having an allergic effect to something, and your body does one thing. It's this cascade, right? It's super complicated. It's lots of different components in your, different things in your body that are releasing chemicals. Those chemicals may or may not react with each other. And depending on what you're allergic to, different things could happen. Yeah. And they manifest in lots of different ways.
It could be like a sinus thing or like an itchy skin thing or a throat thing.
Exactly.
Or the whole not breathing thing.
Yeah. Or the whole, anaphylaxis thing.
Anaphylaxis.
All right, so here's what they're doing. So here is the cool thing. So what they're trying to do, they're attacking this in two different ways. One, they're coming up with a cat food that has I don't think it's a protein. It's something that'll bind to the protein that makes it so it doesn't bind to you. When you breathe it in, it doesn't do anything. Cool. And because the cat eats the food, it's in the cat's mouth, so it'll be something that stays in the cat's mouth for a little while. Some companies are saying that, hey, let's not mess with the cat actually producing this protein, because it's there for a reason. They really do think that the protein exists for a reason that has nothing to do with producing allergies.
But well, I mean, they could do it, you know, like make.
Well, they are. Some companies are doing it, but
then just to see what happens. Okay, let's make a cat that doesn't produce the protein and see what happens.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, it could be that it has a function, but it's not critical.
Yeah.
It could also be something that was more important to cats before they were domesticated and is not so important now. You never know. So, and really, the only way to know for sure is just to knock it out and see what happens.
Yep.
Which is that's a standard thing to do in biology.
So I think that's probably the most viable thing. The other thing is, of course, they can genetically modify the cats with CRISPR, which is what I was saying before.
So here's my question. I know you don't know the answer to this, but so first of all, I think regulatory-wise, is there any regulation you have to go to make a GMO pet?
I doubt it.
Because it's not going to be food, right? Yeah. It's not in the food chain at all.
I sincerely doubt it.
Yeah.
So. There are the laws, at least in the United States, around pets are stricter than the laws around certain wild animals. Yeah. There are some specialized protections for wild animals, and then those laws are stricter than the laws around livestock, right? Like in terms of humane treatment of animals. But you're right, this stuff that's like pre-birth stuff, like if you're talking about doing things with embryos and things like that, I don't know.
Aren't there companies now that will clone your pet for $20,000?
Yeah, I think you could do that.
Yeah, you could do that.
They made like glow-in-the-dark cats.
They put the green fluorescent protein, the jellyfish protein into them.
That's freaking horrifying.
But no, that's awesome.
What glowed? What part of them glowed?
I can't remember. Was it their skin?
Skin,
because, like the jellyfish protein, you can put it in, like, lots of stuff.
Was it a fur? Was it skin?
I think it was their skin.
What would you, George, what would you call a cat that glows? I don't have something. I'm waiting
for you. You can't do that unless you have something.
Well, he made a fool of me before.
Look, Jay, as long as it looks my butt, I'm happy.
Yeah.
my other question is, and this is just like a speculation, what's going to be the reaction of the anti-GMO community, if we CRISPR a GMO cat that works, that is genuinely hypoallergenic. Mm-hmm. I had the same question about, because they're working on hypoallergenic peanuts, because peanut allergies like kill a lot of kids every year, right? Yeah. And it's also like every school is like, this is a peanut-free zone. It's a huge pain.
Yeah, airplanes, you got to be so safe.
If you had, if there were a a non-allergenic peanut, they just take that protein away that makes peanuts, you know, that people have an allergic reaction.
Yeah, but is that going to impact the taste of peanut butter? Because then they can't do it.
Well, that's the question. It maybe tastes like crap.
So Bob's like, listen, but if it affects peanut,
if 500
flavoring,
people have to die so I can have a Reese's Peanut
Butter. Peanut butter. Do I have to say anymore?
Yeah, but Jay's right. You are basically saying let people die so my peanut butter experience is not tainted.
But you're right, Steve. There's a big difference. There's a big difference between genetically modifying a peanut and maybe even completely phasing out of you know, the natural world allergen peanut, which there's like an ethical thing where it's like, why are we bending nature to us? But also
that's
beyond
all
that.
Of agriculture.
Exactly.
It's 100%.
It's all of everything. It's all of civilization and society building and everything. Yeah. But there is kind of the ethical thing of like, okay, but cats are alive unto themselves. They are domesticates, but there is sadly a large feral cat population. And so this question of kind of like bending the biology of a cat to human choices, that is domestication
that is
in a
That's
way.
The whole
it
thing.
Is.
I mean, I care. I see what
the
you're
same
saying.
Thing about us.
I see what you're I think the right thing to do is we should make it so we're not damaging these animals, right? Mm-hmm. Animals have like the right to be happy, healthy, blah blah blah. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're breeding them and taking them into our homes, sure, let's do that.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, making hypoallergenic animals and we're not deteriorating their health by doing it.
Like, but some people would argue that we have, like with like labradoodles and certain types of designer breeds, to be
pretty
more
much,
hypoallergenic.
Yeah, most dog breeds are freak shows, though.
It's
I mean,
dangerous.
Like
not
think
all,
about
over speciation too, like over specified.
Well, that's why.
Think
yeah.
about
yeah.
dachshunds.
Like,
now they're adorable. We owned a dachshund, loved it. But yeah, think about it. They all get back problems.
Yep.
You know, like every breed
with
has
breathing.
Their
can't
vulnerability
breathe, yeah.
to health problems because we made them look weird and adorable.
But some are much worse than others. Yeah, like some are like borderline.
But we already gimped these domestic animals for our own enjoyment.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. But like, is that really the argument? So let's just keep doing it? Or like, should we? Like we already did. So.
You're just saying, should we do something? We already are doing that. That's my only point.
I guess.
I think making a cat hypoallergenic, though, as long as it doesn't hurt the cat, that's
yeah, it's
fine.
One of those things where it's like, you know, it's not a zero-sum game. I get that. It's like when people say, why would we put money in space when there's cancer? Like, of course, those are two completely different conversations. But there is a conversation about like we don't as a society do a good job of, for example, minimizing the feral cat population. We don't do a good job of making sure that the welfare is where it needs to be as it is.
But there are efforts. Like in Connecticut, we had a huge feral cat problem. There's been a massive effort to control it, and it worked.
Yeah, exactly.
I used to drive through Cheshire, and like there's the Cheshire feral cat population. Like you could see them. And now they're gone. So there are efforts, and it does work when they do it.
There would be Cheshire cats running around.
Wow.
Yeah. Cheshire's the next town north of me, and it was overrun with feral cats.
And maybe in a way, this kind of effort.
Seriously.
Maybe in a way, this kind of effort would have actually a positive downstream benefit because people would be less likely to desert their animal. Because people do. I mean, that's why there are feral animals because people go, I don't want this anymore. And they just like leave it outside, which is so sad.
It is. Or you have an outdoor, a purely outdoor cat.
Which you should
they
not
just,
have.
They just breed, you know, reproduce over and over and over.
Yeah, you know? If you're going to let your cat outside, which you should never do, I'm just going to blanket
Unless
that.
You have a you know, some kind of contained yard, but it's just hard for
a cat. What can contain a cat? I mean, it would take
a
laser beams
definitely
and
needs
stuff.
To be, it definitely needs to be fixed. I mean, first and foremost, fix your animals. But beyond that, you shouldn't leave a cat outside. It's very bad for the environment.
All right. Yeah. All right, I'm going to talk about Beetlejuice, the star, not the play slash movie. It's either Beetlejuice or Betelgeuse, right? You guys were asking, like, is it
Betelgeuse?
Betelgeuse,
yeah. But apparently that's wrong.
It's not. It is Beetlejuice.
Are you sure?
I know. We're like, we're the holdouts over here.
Go ahead, check it right now. That's. Yeah. I mean,
please.
That's, I'm going to do it the whole time you're doing
it.
Google
it, Kara. Google it.
I'm giggling.
All right. So there, Beetlejuice has been in the news because there's this question of, when is it going to go supernova, right? It is going to go supernova because it's large enough that we know that. So Betelgeuse is the right shoulder of Orion, right? You guys know the Orion constellation, my favorite constellation because it's the only one that actually looks like what it's supposed to be. But that's the right shoulder. It's like a, this, it's a bright red star. Beetlejuice is a, it's a main sequence star currently in its red supergiant phase. So what does that mean? What's the red supergiant phase? So after stars burn through their hydrogen, so the, and then you know, when stars fuse hydrogen into helium, when enough helium builds up in the core, the density of the hydrogen isn't enough to continue to fuse. So what happens is the star collapses until it does get hot enough to fuse the helium, right? If the star is big enough. If stars may be too small for that to happen, then they just go into their white dwarf phase or the whatever. They
it's
stop.
The interior collapse as well, yeah. Not the whole star.
Right, the interior collapses, the core, as they go up the core. So then what happens is the core of the star collapses until it starts burning helium. There's still hydrogen sort of burning around the core. There's like an envelope of hydrogen fusion. Because, you know, you think about the density, it's going to be greatest in the middle and then less as you go out. So as you go through the density, there's one zone where it's burning hydrogen and then at the core it's burning helium. When that happens, the helium burns hotter. And so the gas of the star heats up and that causes it to expand. Yeah, so then the star starts to expand into, you know, a giant or a supergiant, and it becomes red because as it gets bigger, you know, the surface is cooler. So we know that Betelgeuse is in that phase of its life, right? It's burning burning helium at the core with a shell of hydrogen. It's exploded out. If Betelgeuse was in, this is always a wonderful way to visualize how big it is. If it were in our solar system, it would be out beyond Mars. You know, it'd be like getting close to the star itself would occupy all the way out to beyond Mars, even to Jupiter, like in the on some stars. Okay, what happens when? So what is it burning the helium into? That's the next question, right? What's it burning the helium into? Does anybody know? Carbon. It's combining three helium, which is two protons, right, into one carbon, which is six protons. So the star builds up carbon at the core. And then eventually, there's so much carbon in the core that the density of the helium is not enough to sustain fusion. And then the core collapses. And again, if the star is big enough that, you know, that the density of that carbon core gets dense enough,
hot enough
that will start fusing. So this brings us to, I'm building towards the news item.
Can I ask you a question? Yeah. I don't know if anybody knows the answer. I just find it interesting.
Yeah.
Like the idea of the core collapsing.
Well, let me say that think of a star. It's in a state of there's two forces that are happening. It's trying to, the temperature and the heat is forcing it out, but the gravity is pulling it in. So it's in a balance.
Yeah.
You mess with that balance, you mess with the mass, you mess with the temperature, then it's going to either collapse or expand. So it's always that balance.
Yeah.
So
when the core stops fusing, it stops making the energy that's pushing the star out.
So the gravity
collapses it until... Until whatever, depending on the size of the star. The bigger the star, the more heavier elements it could fuse at its core.
Do we have any idea what that looks like in that second when it happens? Is it like something that happens fast? I don't know. Like, I'd love to see.
So we don't, because none of this is reflected on the surface of the star, because the electromagnetic radiation we can see takes millions of years to filter up to the surface of the star. So all this is happening and we can't see it,
but
which is part of what I'm going to be talking about. That's a very critical point. All right, so for a star the size of Betelgeuse, which, by the way, is 640 light years away, so it's actually really close. So this is one of the closer, it's not the closest, but it's one of the closer stars that it's in the end of its life, so it might go supernova. Betelgeuse can go supernova tomorrow, or it can go supernova in 50,000 years. We don't know.
How many solar masses is Betelgeuse?
It's 20 solar masses.
20, all right.
20
then,
solar, to 20 times as massive as our star.
And it's the 11th brightest star in the sky.
Yeah, thank you. 11th brightest star in the sky.
Oh, it used to be.
Still haven't found the pronunciation.
It's lost him,
it's a little complicated.
It's complicated.
Yeah. But it's either Betel or Beetle.
Yeah.
Could be either one. The second, it's apparently an Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
It's an Arabic word.
Yad al-Jawsa.
That was a mistranslation. It either means the armpit of Orion or the hand of Orion.
Yeah.
And the Y was mispronounced
and
as a
B. And the Y was a B. Oh, so it actually might be Yiddle.
Yaddle Gauss.
Yeah, but that's the anglicization of... Yeah.
And some people are saying that because it's either Betel or Beetle or it doesn't really matter, that after the movie, everyone went Beetle.
Yeah.
It was literally the movie that changed
George,
how
I've heard it both ways.
The correctly pronounced name sounds like something that... that you know, Yaddle Gaiden, right?
Yaddle
Gaiden. Jerry Lewis.
Yeah, Jerry Lewis.
Yaddle Jowsy with the blowing up of the Red Star. It's going to go boom tomorrow, maybe.
Maybe.
Cool. Could be 50,000 years.
So the car, so the you know, stars last for, you know, millions, billions of years, right? The bigger the star, actually, the shorter its life. A large star the size of Betelgeuse will last hundreds of millions of years. But once it starts fusing carbon, that phase only lasts for 100,000 years. That's why we know it's in the supergiant phase. Its lifespan now has got to be less than 100,000 years.
Can we see it when it starts doing that? Does it change its color or anything?
Sure. It starts doing what?
The 100,000-year countdown.
Expanding so,
well, yeah, that's when it blows up into the supergiant phase.
Oh, all right,
but
it gets bigger.
But then it's in that phase.
That happened a while ago.
Yeah, see, I want something dramatic. I want a color change.
Well, hang on.
I want, like, flashing lights.
All right, so then it burns carbon.
Going cats, everything.
Burns carbon into neon, right?
There you go.
Wow. Yes.
Right, that phase takes...
So it does blink.
It only survives in that phase for a few years.
Wow.
Yeah, then it burns oxygen for a few months.
Then it burns all the old furniture in the basement because right. No one's going to buy it.
And then silicon for 1 to 2 days most. Right. So once it's burning silicon, it's like it has a lifespan of 2 days.
It's like,
most.
I'm dying!
Right. Now, all of this is happening with no change to the surface of the star because, again, it's all happening in the core.
Right.
And again, there's always a shell. So you can have like carbon with a shell of helium with a shell of hydrogen, and then you get neon.
That's
with a shell
typical.
Of carbon with, yeah, so
most people on the outside don't know what's going on in the inside.
That's true.
You know?
All right, but there is one thing. So why does the light take millions of years to get to the surface?
Because it's bouncing around. Yeah.
But what doesn't take millions of years
heat.
To get
Ooh,
to the surface?
Heat.
Bob knows. No.
Neutrinos.
Neutrinos,
of course.
Neutrinos just pass right through everything. That's why part of the reason why we get a neutrino pulse is the first sign of a supernova. Mm-hmm.
How long does it?
But for the neutrinos that would come from a supernova,
yeah,
neutrinos and gravitational waves. Apparently, we'd have about a day. So we'd have so from that. But you're talking about another neutrino creation process. Then?
All right. Now we're finally at the actual new news item, right? So this is another signal, neutrino based signal that we would get before the visible supernova, right? Which is critical because then we could, like, if we know a day ahead of time that it's going to happen, we could turn all of our telescopes to Betelgeuse or whatever and then see a supernova happening from the beginning to the end. Now, like, we see the supernova and then we look at it, but we've already missed the beginning of it, right?
So the neutrinos that'll be put off by the supernova, it's like a large enough, big enough thing that we'll know.
Yeah. So yeah, let me tell you exactly what's going to happen.
Okay.
So neutrinos can be of different energies, just like light can be of different energies, right? Mm.
Spectrum.
As the cores burn heavier and heavier elements, they're also burning hotter and hotter. Mm. And the neutrinos that they're producing are also hotter and hotter, right? So at some point, there's a critical energy threshold, which they just say it's E to the TH, right? The energy threshold. So there's this critical energy threshold.
Potatoes.
The burning of the core is so hot that it starts to form positrons. Positrons are positively charged electrons. And the positrons will immediately annihilate with any electron that's in the vicinity. And when the positron and the electron annihilate each other, right, because they're opposite particles, they create neutrinos and antineutrinos, right? The neutrinos and antineutrinos fly away in every direction. So they don't necessarily immediately annihilate each other because they get radiated away immediately. Whereas the positrons and the electrons are physically in...
They're like local.
Yeah, they're local. So they'll annihilate each other. So that means that neutrinos and antineutrinos will stream towards the Earth, right? And if they are energetic enough, and this is where the supernova thing comes in, because only at the very end stage are they going to get energetic enough. Those really energetic antineutrinos, right, which resulted from the core collapse right before a supernova, you with me so far? Mm-hmm. When they hit our neutrino detectors, they will cause protons to combine with positrons forming inverse beta decay. Now, inverse beta decay is an otherwise very rare event.
Bob, okay. You following this?
Yeah. Right? So that's
I'm not.
Will Like, yeah. We'll know. The neutrino detectors will see this.
So the neutrino detectors might see, like, one or two a day, yeah. depending on how big the detector is, all from our nuclear power plants mm-hmm. and from uranium in the crust of the Earth. Like, there's a little background neutrino things going through the detectors. And
solar neutrinos, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and then so there's this, you know, rarely we'll see in this inverse beta decay happen. And then suddenly we're going to see hundreds of them, mm-hmm. right away, all at once. And then we'll know a supernova just happened somewhere, right? But we can also tell the direction. By the neutrino detectors can tell the direction.
That's awesome.
And so we'll say there's a pulse of highly energetic, supernova level, highly energetic antineutrinos coming from over there.
Yeah, and then we can turn.
And there's a star there that we know is big enough to go supernova. And so let's turn our telescopes at that star.
So we already know Betelgeuse might be supernovaing soon, but is there a chance that there'd be something that we don't know, but we could get a neutrino pulse from?
Absolutely.
So either way, it's really informative because we know to now scan that patch of sky.
So is this new? This is a new technology?
It's a new finding. That it's a prediction of what we should expect to see in our neutrino detectors.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like our early warning system.
Yeah.
Cool.
And so
how far away is Betelgeuse?
640 light years.
So, like, that's what kills me is that this could have, I mean, this probably already happened already.
It could have happened already.
It's just so weird. It's like, I'm just waiting for the proof yet bit.
The first time I read about this, a galaxy should see a supernova like once a century. Right, we hadn't seen one since like Galileo's time. So we're like, where are the supernovas in the Milky Way? So in 1987, we finally saw a supernova in one of the Magellanic Cloud dwarf galaxies mm-hmm. orbiting our galaxy. And the first thing that we saw were the neutrinos. Yeah. Like, oh wow, check that out. So this is kind of what's happening. But it turns out that there have been supernovas in our galaxy, but they were kind of hidden on the far end, hidden by dust at the far end of our galaxy.
So we never saw them, but we did see the neutrinos.
So when Galileo's era, or Galileo himself, saw the supernova, like, what did they see?
You just see a star get bright, and it's...
For how long?
About 2 weeks, 1 to 2 weeks.
So if Betelgeuse goes supernova, uh-huh. I looked into this, what would we say?
Yeah,
what are we going to say? 642 light years away, so we're safe. If it's closer than 39 light years, not good.
We could actually
the radiation could you know kill animals and
so
kill
another reason to not be close to other solar systems.
Yeah, I mean if you had
as if
a,
we have a
supernova
choice.
Like 5 or 10 light years away, yeah. Well,
what that practically means is, should we be looking for life in places that are so densely packed with stars that they probably get sterilized every billion years or so, or 500 right. million years or
so. Well, we've only been around for like a, you know.
Yeah, but the thing is, you want to be in a part of your galaxy where it's actually interesting. This is sort mm-hmm. of the where's the life rich part of the galaxy?
Yeah,
there's a couple of variables. One is you need to have a certain amount of metallicity, right? You need to be metal rich, which basically means that
older stars
have already gone supernova and spewed out their heavier elements into the clouds that then formed your system. And so you need to be in a part of the galaxy where there's a lot of clouds enriched with heavier elements.
Okay.
And they call that metallicity. Right? So you're going to be in a metal rich part of the galaxy, but not so tightly packed that you're likely to get sterilized every now and then by a local gamma ray burst or a local supernova. So we're kind of like in the perfect zone, you know, which is not a surprise, you know, that we're in the Goldilocks zone of the galaxy, just like we're in the Goldilocks zone of our solar system in a Goldilocks star, of course, because we are life. And so,
but for all intents and purposes, our life has only been evolving for a few billion years.
Yeah,
so
right. like that's a long period of stability over over.
So you're talking about like every billion.
Or even 100
or
million
okay,
or 50
gotcha.
Million. Yeah.
So what if Betelgeuse goes tomorrow? What are we going to see? So imagine you've got a half full moon condensed down to like the size of a star. So this would be a bright beacon in the sky. At night it would cast shadows.
Like a full moon.
Half of a full moon. One ninth. As bright as a full moon.
So how much brighter than Jupiter would you say that? Like Jupiter's probably like by far the brightest thing.
It would be the brightest thing in the sky other than the sun and the moon. Right?
But you would see this at night. It would cast shadows. You would see it during the day for a year, for a full year. You would see this thing in the sky.
I thought it was 2 weeks.
No, it would be.
Well, that's the big, the very bright phase of the supernova. Right, is a couple of weeks.
Yeah, but you would be able to point to it and say, "There it is," for about a year.
It would cast shadows at night.
Cast shadows at night. Now, 3 months at night, it would be a half full moon for 3 months, and then
does
it would slowly dim,
shadows?
Slowly dim.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Like literally never tested that.
Now, guys, imagine we get a neutrino or gravitational wave pulse, and we're like, holy shit, Betelgeuse is going to blow. Not only would all the telescopes, everyone on, I think a lot of the cool people on the planet would be like, all right, and
I want to see it blow.
Yeah. You would actually see a point, you would see a star brighten into a supernova. That I want to see that before I die.
Not enough astronomical things happen. Like when Hellbop came, remember, we were watching it, and it looked really cool, and it was like something to look at. I wish there was more stuff happening.
Right, because for me, it's like the naked eye events. Like, for example,
the eclipse.
Eclipse.
That was freaking awesome. No, that was like the coolest thing that's ever happened.
We're going to see the next eclipse.
Yeah,
I'm right. telling you, you guys, you have to. We only have like.
But we had.
There's other things.
In
Bob's
our lifetime,
curse.
In
Bob's
the U.S.
Curse.
Bob's yeah.
Bob's just
cursed.
Come hang out with me in Texas. It goes right over my mom's house.
It will be overcast. It will be cloudy. The apocalypse. Something will happen. To prevent you from
my good luck will block your curse. I promise. Because I got
my curse.
Epic viewing. I got. Epic
but we had the worst viewing. The worst viewing of Halley's Comet in 2,000 years. That's how bad Bob's curse
is. Because of me.
But okay, don't come to my mom's house in Texas.
I mean, I love astronomy. This is one of the things I want to see. Like, for example, not a meteor shower. I want to see a meteor storm where you're going through such a dense cloud of meteors that it's happened, like, in the late 1800s. Yeah. It was, imagine, if a good storm, a good shower is, like, one or two a minute.
Yeah.
Imagine 100 every second.
Yeah. Bob, but I saw a documentary about this.
Well, don't,
and
what,
you,
are you going
to
burst my
bubble? And then plants start to animate?
Yes. Yeah. I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. But also, who was it? Somebody, it was some scientist who saw a meteor hit the moon. He's looking at the moon, and all of a sudden, it's something hit it. It's like, what the hell? I mean, something like that. I want to see something that you're looking at the
all
sky.
Bob, calm down.
I want to see this, Jay. I know.
I do, too. If you remember, I'm the one that said this, but I'm not, like, writing freaking poetry about
but
it.
Even if, but even
here's
if
the
it's
thing
the
that's
end
annoying.
Of the world, I'm going to enjoy it. For
these
the
events
seconds.
Do happen a lot, but people just don't take the time to look at them. Like, yeah. I can go, when the Perseids come around,
they
there,
don't
are,
happen a lot.
There are amazing meteor showers multiple times a year, but you have to, like, do a little work. Go to a slightly darker patch of the sky, lay on your back for a few hours.
Let yourself dark adapt. I've seen it, but a few per
it's
minute's
amazing.
Cool. But I want to see like 100 every second. That's when. That's the.
But can
real
you can
cool
you imagine
stuff.
if there's a spot in the sky which is as bright as the moon during the day? Can you imagine the resultant woo?
Oh yeah,
that's going to be like that's going to be associated with it. That's going to be it's going to be explaining why brooms are now talking.
Yeah.
Or whatever the thing may be, like it's going to be this. Crazy bunch
or it
of
could
nonsense.
Maybe people be like, "What's happening?" It'll be everyone will be talking about it. Everybody, it'll
Speaking
be all over the news.
Yeah, yes. I'm trying to segue over to Kara. The last news item. So, Kara, if someone wants to find their perfect mate,
don't do it this way.
Yeah. So, is there an app for that?
Kind of. Yeah.
Come to the extravaganza.
Ooh.
We're talking pseudoscience. We're talking immune responses. Like, this actually connects to a lot of the topics that we've already discussed. I stumbled upon, it's kind of like an op-ed blog post thing on SIAM about, it's called the Illusion of Genetic Romance. So there's not necessarily a news hook in the sense that nothing is brand new in this, but it's such a thing that I think it's important for us to keep our eyes open about. And this is so like the upper echelon. This is pseudoscience. It's like utilizing sciencey sounding things and legitimate science things to sell garbage. So there are a few companies starting all over the world. The most recent one is a Japanese startup where for 86,400 yen, which is $790 at the time of this exchange, this company called Nozze. Nose? I don't know. N-O-Z-Z-E. How would you pronounce that? N-O-Z-Z-E.
Naza?
Naza? I don't know.
Two Z's is a T, right?
Is going to do a DNA matching party for you. And so they're going to take... Yeah.
There's never any trouble when Nazi and DNA matching comes together.
It's all good. It's going to be great. You'll find your soulmate, we promise.
This is basically the whole point of why this is a problem.
Just step in this room and disrobe, and it'll be
so
great.
Whoa.
1,600 variations in what they call HLA gene complexes. So let's do two acronyms. This will help. So have you guys heard of the major histocompatibility complex?
No, okay. Of course.
Yeah. So
I like their early albums better than this later stuff.
So histocompatibility is just a general term for tissue compatibility or cellular compatibility. And there's reasons, right, if you get an organ transplant or you get stem cells or something put into your body, like a foreign biological information from another person, that sometimes you will reject it and sometimes you'll accept it. And we know about blood typing, and that's kind of a different thing. But there are these markers on your physical cells, right? So they exist. There are these antigens on top of the cells. And the HLA is a human leukocyte antigen, and that's really the one that it seems that the major histocompatibility.
That's an initialism, not an acronym.
Yeah. Initially. What's the difference? An acronym
you can
spells
pronounce
something?
It. Oh, you pronounce it. An acronym.
Well, like Fabi.
Bob loves that piece of trivia.
It's one of the things like, I like being pedantic about.
Okay, so the HLA.
Like Skoo.
The HLA is a very important. Okay, so anyway, this is where science meets marketing, I think, in a major way. So there are studies that have been done in mice, in, this is really great, pheasants, and also in fish, and in bats, that have shown that the major histocompatibility complex does seem to have positive outcomes for mate selection. So when they have had individual organisms would mate and produce viable offspring, then they compare their MHC and they find that there is compatibility within the histocompatibility complex.
I have to date a pheasant now?
Yeah, right? It's weird. So they tried it. They tried it in sheep. It didn't work. There's one study that seems to be a viable, like an important study, with a group of, it's such a weird name, Hutterite couples. Have you guys heard of Hutterites?
Yeah, Hutterites.
Hutterites. Thank you. Hutterites who have, their DNA is very well studied because it's it's a very insulated community, and there's a lot of sibling mating, and not like brother and sister, but like pairs of siblings will mate with other pairs of siblings. And so you see these like really firm family lineages. And there was a study done with these individuals where they looked at the couples to see if the compatibility played a role in their assortive or non-assortive mating practices, and they found that there was actually a significant effect, that these individuals, once they were typed, they could see that they were tended to be choosing to some extent along these lines. That said, we have to remember, there were no studies done about whether or not they were happy, whether or not their marriage was working, whether or not they actually liked each other. What it does seem to be the case is that a lot of this research into the kind of relationship between the major histocompatibility complex and compatibility is actually research into...
But it's got compatible right in the
exactly.
name.
Exactly. But it actually seems to be research into how viable the offspring are, right? So, like, are there spontaneous abortions that are occurring? Are there, you know, successful mating roles? So, A, is that how you guys define, like, whether or not you want to, like, date somebody? Is if, like, you make good babies? Like, some people do. Don't get me wrong.
But, you know, there's a lot simpler... you know, heuristic for making good babies, and that is just, you know, date somebody who doesn't look like you. That's just that somebody's, you know, from a different, you know, subpopulation, yeah, nationality, whatever.
That almost flies in the face of how most people would think about that. You're right. From a biologic genetic
just outbreed.
Perspective, yeah.
Yeah, if that's your goal. If you're like, I don't want to, you know, have recessive diseases, and don't date your cousin, you know.
Exactly. But the thing is...
let me write this down.
But the funny thing is that we know from thousands, hundreds of thousands of years of human psychology that people tend more often to date within their family groups. They are more attracted to people who look like them. Who think like that?
Yeah, but
who
so talk and like does that. This kind of analysis help if you're already within your own small genetic?
And that's the thing; they've only looked at it in Hutterites, so yeah. They are only within their small genetic subpopulation.
But and also, again, saying that they do tend to sort. First of all, there's like confounding factors galore
out the wazoo.
Yeah,
absolutely.
For something like that, it doesn't tell you that they're not like sniffing each other's HLA type, right? So it's probably a marker. That's why I know that there's in some animals there may be hormonal ways to do
and,
that.
And the reason that the...
We don't date.
No, but the reason that the research opened up in humans and they decided to do the Hutterite story is because in the 80s there was this like classic, you guys have heard of the t-shirt sniffing study, where basically t-shirts were given to men, they worked out in them and sweated a lot, and then they put them in boxes and women... were meant to smell them and then rate how attracted they were to the men. And they actually did find some, although they haven't really been able to replicate it, some sorting based on histocompatibility complex.
Wait, so what was that? Was that related to the wet T-shirt?
No.
That's the guy version of it. We do the wet T-shirt.
No relation?
Nothing care.
So, we do
know... That's a much more effective method, though, the wet T-shirt.
Yeah. So, we do know that there are organizations out there right now, like the Committee for the Prevention of Jewish Genetic Diseases, which is also called Dor Yeshorim, which is a voluntary testing project, you know, trying to reduce Tay-Sachs and Creutzfeldt Jakob and different kinds of genetic disorders. So it's like, okay, let's get tested. I think certain states used to require like blood typing before you would get married, because there's also this idea of like you have to be married to have kids. Apparently, that's like a thing.
Yeah, but you might make certain requirements before you can get a marriage license.
Yeah.
You have to prove that you're not related to each other.
Yeah, which is like okay,
that's like a thing in some states.
Yeah, as if A, you have to be married to have a kid, and B, that's why everybody gets married. But whatever. So the idea here is that there are already some, I don't want to put a value judgment on it, but legitimate, you know, pushes to try and ensure that horrific genetic diseases are not being passed on within the population, because we see that there's like a net positive benefit of reducing the burden of like terrible genetic diseases, both in terms of the burden of the parents, but also in terms of the burden of the state, right? This is very expensive to care for kids who are very, very sick. And so that, to some extent, makes sense, but this is kind of like taking an idea that has like a kernel of scientific truth and running with it to an extreme side.
It's also a very backdoor way of getting to that. So what we do now is, like, if you have a family history anywhere of any, you know, genetic disease, and especially if you're you know, the person that you're going to have children with, your spouse or whatever, is of a similar genetic background, right? You could do things like test for those specific genetic diseases, and you could also do things like in vitro fertilization, where you pick the eggs that don't have the genetic mutation.
If that's something that your culture and your religion allows for, right? Because sometimes these things are passed on within that type of sorting.
So like HLA typing is not going to get you there. And we don't even know if that really is going to be predictive enough.
And also that's kind of – the whole point is that's not the point.
Yeah.
Like the idea with these basically marketing schemes, these expensive matchmaking services, is that they're trying to say, we'll look at your HLA, we'll look at their HLA, we'll see where they're compatible, and then we'll hook you up on a date.
Yeah, right.
As if that's going to have any bearing on whether or not you enjoy each other's company, on whether or not you are
want to have kids.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, like, we think that similarity is actually a precursor, a marker, right? We think that that's a good way to measure whether or not there's going to be success in a relationship, because people think, oh, we like the same movies. Oh, we're interested in the same things. We both are into comedy. We both are whatever. But the truth is, social psychology study after study show that actually it has nothing to do with similarity. And what's the most predictive of people rating their marital bliss or their happiness in relationships is actual traits of their partner. So, like, my partner is a caring person. My partner is empathetic. My partner is good at communication. Not my partner is similar to me in all these different ways.
Right. Yep.
So it's I think, an interesting conversation. It's something that's important to point out, because these are scams that are starting to pop up everywhere, and they're very expensive. It's very like, ooh, it's based on science.
Yeah.
Do you guys
see again
these,
a black box science
These DNA tests, right? Like, we had for a very long time Ancestry.com, 23andMe, and now all of a sudden when you go to the pharmacy, you see these like food sensitivity DNA tests and these do I have allergies DNA tests, and these, and none of them are FDA approved, and it's really kind of like, ooh, what are they trying to do?
They're trying to make money.
Of course. But the interesting thing beyond that are the ethical questions, right? Not just the ethical questions of collecting somebody's personal data in the form of their genetic code, but also the ethical questions of actually mating, producing offspring, if that ultimately is a goal, based on specific selective traits. And like historically, we could only do it through non-assortive mating. We could choose to breed. I can say, you have stuff going on, I might want to make a baby with you. But it's getting more and more likely that very soon we'll be able to say, I want these traits, and I want those traits, and I want these traits. And we're getting inching closer and closer to a eugenic future, and that's really where I think there's...
But at the same time, because of CRISPR or whatnot, you don't have to get the traits with your sorting. You could just genetically engineer the traits.
You can also just genetically engineer, which is almost...
And that's going to swamp any other technique. I mean, it's how far are we away from making that a
reality? But this is why these ethics boards are putting the kibosh on that in a major, major way. Like CRISPR right now is a viable, the first clinical trial actually just proved, it was safe. Yeah. It's a viable option for reducing the risk of genetic disease. Yes. This is the only thing that any ethics board is comfortable with now.
In my opinion, once we are comfortable with that,
where does that go?
Designer kids are inevitable.
I don't think so. I don't think it's
absolutely
inevitable.
How many people have ever had braces, right, growing up? Like, a third, a half had braces. Like, do you want to put metal bars in your teeth and, like, force them into the right shape for 2-3 years? We're going to attach, you know, whereas we could turn a gene on or off. And give your kids straight teeth.
But here's the thing. That same argument could be made. How many kids had braces? Wasn't it horrible growing up with braces? Wouldn't you rather just have perfect teeth? How many kids grew up black? Wasn't it horrible living in this culture when you grew up black? Wouldn't it be easier if you just weren't black?
Shit, that's,
and those, it's true.
Shit, that,
it's
you got so real right now.
But
I had a hard time.
It's not, though. It's with the foundation. That is the eugenics.
I would say, like tall people are more successful. So do you want your kid to be tall?
Yeah. But that's because...
Like, that's a much more...
It's the same thing.
Think about cultures where... There's a people would rather have a male child than a female child.
Sure,
right. And then as soon as the availability came of doing DNA testing to know what kind of child you're going to have or do an ultrasound and then an abortion.
Yep.
And those cultures are doing, sexually selected abortions.
Right. And those aren't,
they want to have their one child be male.
And those aren't individual choices.
And that's a horrible thing for society.
Yeah.
It's an individual choice that you make as the end user, but there's so many societal pressures that lead you to making that decision that it's a complicated ethical question.
It's a setup for unintended consequences because of collectively, who knows what decisions people are going to be making. All right, we're going to move on.
It's time for science or fiction.
Science or fiction. There is a theme this week. The theme is, it's not Seattle.
Damn.
I studied.
Me too.
It is the Pacific Northwest.
Oh. Ooh, is there a Bigfoot question?
Huh?
Is there a Bigfoot question?
Maybe.
How could there not be a Bigfoot
question? I know, right?
All right. There are four items that all have something to do in some way about the Pacific Northwest. Are you ready? The name Sasquatch derives from the First Nation name Sasket. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. It's Sasq'et, right? Although references say that there are other sources, but that's the most common one, which did refer to a hairy wild man, but by tradition was diminutive in size. Item number two, the Pacific Northwest contains rainforests with the highest biomass density on Earth. Item number three, Washington State has over 3,000 perennial ice and snow fields, including 186 named glaciers. And item number four, the Seahawk is not a real bird, and the NFL team uses an African auger hawk as their live mascot. All right. Do not scroll to the next screen.
We're not going
to
ask. Well, no, they
no
can't,
we're going to do them second. We're going to do the audience second because I figure you guys might
no scrolling,
have
Bob.
Some insight into
All right.
these.
No scrolling. Sasquatch, that sounds possible. Ice and snow fields. I mean, Seahawk. The one that kind of made me think was the highest biomass. I think highest biomass density would be closer to the equator. So I'll say that's fiction.
Do you guys ever hear Mitch Hedberg say that Bigfoot is actually blurry? And it makes him extra...
Do you love that?
He's actually blurry, and that's extra scary to me.
That picture is in focus.
It's not the photographer's fault.
It is not the photographer's fault.
I don't know. I kind of remember something about the small Bigfoots. I don't know.
Small Bigfoots. Giant shrimp.
I don't think there are Seahawks. That's my fiction.
But
wait,
that would make it true.
No,
that was the premise.
Steve, someone explain the game to Jay. It's a new item we're doing.
I believe there are real Seahawks.
Okay,
I'm going to go with the rainforest one.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say that. Like, I do think there are rainforests here.
Gee, BWB.
But with the highest biomass on Earth is the question. And the thing is, like, are you talking about there's they found 1 square meter where there was more, or are you talking about on average?
That's a bio.
Yeah. Then I think that probably is actually the fiction, because at least it's always cited that the Amazon has the highest biomass on Earth, like across the board. Yeah. I mean, that's constantly cited. Right. So I don't know if that's wrong. The other one that really is like amazing is the 3,000 perennial ice and snow fields, but I buy it. I mean, it's Washington State, right? Like it's it's very northerly. I also agree that the Seahawk is probably real. So I don't know. I guess I got to go with Bob and Jay on this. I go out on a limb a lot in these private shows, and I lose constantly.
Yeah, it's hard.
I'm just gonna play it safe, strengthen numbers.
My initial thing was that there aren't rainforests out here, that there are forests, but are they rainforests? But I guess people started nodding, so yeah. Yeah, dummy. So I was going to go with that, but I think I'm going to go with the perennial ice and snow fields. I don't. Maybe it's not that many. And 186 named glaciers. Yeah, that seems.
And Washington State's small, right?
Yeah, it seems a little high, but I'm going to say the perennial ice and the glaciers.
Okay,
I'm out on a limb.
Let's see what the audience thinks. See, do you influence them or if they agree with you? So, if you think, through George, you're going to do the clap.
Yeah, a single clap, right?
Yeah, we'll do. If you think the Sasquatch one being diminutive is the fiction, clap.
Ooh.
Okay. Everyone buys that one. Okay. If you think that the highest biomass density is the fiction, clap.
If you think
that the 3,000 perennial ice and snow fields is the fiction, clap. And if you think that the Seahawk does exist, clap. Three people. All right.
All right. Feeling good.
Not bad.
So either you guys are correct, or you influenced them, or I'm an evil genius. One of those is the case. So, George, before I do the reveal, so we're walking to breakfast this morning, and George's like, oh, by the way, or Jay, we're taking umbrellas, and Jay's like, oh, this is like, it's so rainy here. It's like, oh, by the way, I've read that that's not true, that New York has more rainfall than Seattle.
So he had to rewrite his
I had to rewrite one of my, because that was one of the choices. But you screwed yourself out of an easy science reflection.
Yeah, it's true.
Because so Seattle has 38 inches a year of rainfall, which is the national average. You guys have average rainfall. New York City has 45 inches per year, so it's a lot more. And I thought I would have gotten these guys dead because they were very surprised by that fact.
It's not more rain, it's just constant.
It's a lot of little rain.
That was the look you gave me. I thought it was just gas. I thought it was just kind of giving me the flu.
We should just throw out facts of wherever we are at these shows.
That's all I do anyways.
Well, that's why I went Pacific Northwest, because I figured you guys would be, you're on to the whole I do the city thing where we are. All right. Let's take this in reverse order. I think that matches best with everyone's choices. So the Seahawk is not a real bird, and the NFL team uses an African auger hawk as their live mascot. That one is science. Seahawk is not a real bird. There's no such thing as the Seahawk. That's why they're using an African hawk as their bird. The coloring, if the coloring of the, not the live mascot, but the costumed mascot, does that correspond to any bird? No. Those colors were chosen in order to honor a local First Nation tradition.
Cool.
I'm going to fail at pronouncing their name, but their name is the Kwakwaka'wakw. That's the name of the tribe. Yep.
Cool.
It's a lot of K's, W's, and A's. Mm-hmm. That's the color scheme came from that. So it was just some non-existent hawk with the non-existent color scheme.
Well, that's good. It can't offend anybody, I guess.
No,
this is actually like the opposite of what the Redskins are doing. It's like the progressive way to honor.
I mean, the only one who gets offended is ornithologists. Seahawk. Let's go on to the next
football crossover.
One.
I'm sorry, but there are no Seahawks, sir.
The football players are very impressed by that. All right. So number three, Washington State has over 3,000 perennial ice and snow fields, including 186 named glaciers. George, you think this one is the fiction? About a third, I would say, of the audience think this one is the fiction, and this one is science.
Yes.
GWB. So do you guys know what the definition of a glacier is?
Yes.
No.
Say it.
Floating ice.
Floating?
Flowing.
Flowing,
that's what I said.
Yeah. So it's got to be moving.
Yes.
It's got to be moving.
Exactly. It has to be moving.
That's why there's 3,000 perennial
yes.
Perennial isotopes. So you can look by satellite, you can see every little patch they're all year round, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a perennial ice and snow field. There's like 378 or whatever, something like that.
What do you call ice that doesn't move?
Ice.
So
If there's snow there all year round, over time it gets compacted into ice. Mm-hmm. And when it gets about 100 feet thick, the ice itself is thick enough that it can flow under gravity, under 1G, and so then it becomes a glacier, right? If it's flowing even very, very slowly, then it's technically a glacier. If it's not flowing, it's just a perennial ice field, right?
Oh, okay.
And if it's not turned into ice yet, it's a perennial snow field.
That's cool.
So, yeah, that's cool. So Washington State has 449 square kilometers of glaciers. It's the second largest number in the United States. What state has the most?
Alaska.
Alaska has 90,000 square
kilometers.
Oh, shit. Little bit more.
Alaska is just a big glacier.
It's just a big glacier, yeah.
Not
all
so
right,
long.
What's the third state?
Florida.
Canada.
Wyoming. I didn't hear any Wyomings in there. Wyoming at 74, a distant third.
Okay.
Did you know that when the glaciers were covered the United States, it actually compressed the crust of the earth, that tectonic plate, so much that... Now that it's receded, it's still decompressing and rising.
That's cool. It's so cool. Would that be like that? Might help us with the ocean rising?
Negligibly, no, not noticeably.
All right, two more. So the next one's either a science or a fiction. The Pacific Northwest contains rainforests with the highest biomass density on Earth. Mm. The rest of the panel and the majority of the audience...
Oh, my God, you said biomass density, not correct. Biodiversity.
That's correct.
Yes,
that is correct.
And there are these big trees up here.
And I didn't smile when you made that mistake. Because this one is science. Absolutely
what?
Science.
Biomass density.
Biomass density,
think
not
about the
biodiversity.
Trees up here. They're
yes.
So heavy.
It's because it has the tallest trees, the biggest trees with by far the greatest biomass. Mm-hmm. Except actually, the biggest trees are actually not in the Pacific Northwest. Wow. They're the giant sequoias in California, right, in the Sierra Nevadas. Actually, only in a very thin strip along the western slopes of the Sierra Nevadas.
But those aren't rainforest.
Yeah, that's not rainforest. But there are sequoias, just not the giant sequoias. The most populous trees are pine trees, in the Pacific Northwest, just not the sequoias, but there are other kinds. And they're huge. Like, the biggest trees. They're enormous. They're tall. They're like 200 feet tall. The giant sequoias can get up like 300 feet, even the biggest ones even bigger. And it's not just the giant trees, which have massive, it's the biggest carbon sink and biomass. The soil has actually even more carbon than things above the soil.
Wow.
The soil is really, really rich here. This is why they can grow their trees so big, for whatever reason. I'm actually 100% sure why that is. And there's also, the undergrowth. You add it all up, it's the most dense biomass. So I thought I would get people on two parts of that.
Because you said rainforest.
The rainforest. Because
you didn't
I had
say
this,
tropical rainforest.
It's not tropical rainforest.
Yeah.
It's temperate rainforest. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the temperate rainforests of the Pacific Northwest are the biggest temperate rainforest in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Damn.
Fred Seattle, ladies and gentlemen.
So you got that going for you. And which is nice. And it is a very, very, very important carbon sink, in the world.
Yeah.
And it's being threatened by global warming because it's a very, you have a lot of factors that come together to make the ability to have this density. It is partly because it's a rainforest, it's a lot of water, it's good soil, it's just it's the biomass that is here. And that is going to be moving north, So technically I had to look it up because it wasn't totally obvious. There's multiple different ways to define the Pacific Northwest. It isn't one agreed upon definition, but it's basically Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and British Columbia. Right, it's basically that, but the people draw the lines a little bit differently depending on if you're following biomes or whatever. Yeah, but it's kind of basically that's where it is.
So wait, this is good news though, because it means that even though you swept us, which sucks.
Yeah.
But of all the episodes with the broom story, it's kind of it's kind of perfect.
If we hadn't picked that one, I don't think you still would have swept us.
I know, because you guys were debating
we
two
were
and three.
Yeah.
You guys all fell for the fiction, which is the name Sasquatch derives from the First Nation name Sasquatch. which did refer to a hairy wild man, but by tradition was diminutive in size. That part is the fiction.
Because it's Bigfoot.
Because it's
always been Bigfoot,
so
right?
So there's tons of, well, the term Bigfoot is an American journalist creation. There's actually one researcher who kind of popularized that. Actually, no, it was a journalist who popularized Bigfoot. It was a researcher who popularized Sasquatch, mm-hmm. which was his mispronunciation or anglicization of multiple First Nation names that refer to the wild hairy man of the forest,
but
right?
He was big.
But he was big. In all the traditions, he's big. Mm-hmm. You know, it's either like normal size or big, right? Mm-hmm. They're either just like hairy Indians or they're hairy mm-hmm. creatures, but there's no diminutive version of it. It's either normal to or they're big. They're 8 feet tall or something. Yeah. Right. But I thought that was
good job, Steve.
That's kind of the skeptical bias. And I was actually looking for when I was researching that item, I was looking to make that the science. I was trying to find like that the Sasquatch derived from something that had nothing to do with Bigfoot. And I found no, it actually was kind of the tradition is kind of close to Bigfoot. So I said that'll make that one the fiction and everybody will fall for it.
Damn it.
Worked perfectly. All right. So good job, the three people who clapped out there.
Yeah.
So Evan is not here because Evan is doing other people's taxes, which apparently he likes. But so, Jay, you're going to cover the quote for this week.
Yes, I have a great quote. It goes, "I'm happy as long as a cat licks my butt." George Rock.
Yeah, it's my epitaph.
That's not my quote.
You're such a tease.
So I used to do the quotes, as some of you might know. I picked this quote because of the year that we're about to have here with the election coming up, and this is like a nice little moral thing here. Ready? This is the seven social sins. Wealth without work, pleasure without conscience, knowledge without character, commerce without morality, science without humanity, worship without sacrifice, politics without principle. This was from a sermon given by Frederick Lewis Donaldson in Westminster Abbey, London, in March 20th,
1925.
Very nice. I'm sorry. How did I not do that? That was a quote by Frederick Lewis Donaldson. Thank you. I got so excited.
You got a little bit.
I got excited. I haven't done it in years. I haven't even remembered last time I yelled at
you. That's a really good one, Jay.
Thank you.
That's a really, really good one.
I thought.
Really good.
Thank you guys all for joining me. And thank you all for joining us. We had a good time. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.